Welcome to the program for Friday, November 2nd, 2012 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Every Friday in the 3 o'clock hour, it is the Federal News Countdown. Two people who are experts in the world of the federal government choose the news stories they think are most important to people who work for the federal government. We count them down on the Federal News Countdown. This week we have one veteran and one rookie on the Federal News Countdown. My veteran is Larry Allen, president of Allen Federal Business Partners. It's good to see you, my friend.
Great to be here, Francis.
And you survived Sandy fine.
Survived Sandy. We have power back on at the intergalactic headquarters.
It's great to see you, as always. And our rookie on the countdown this week is Ron Sanders of Booz Allen Hamilton. It's great to see you, Ron.
Oh, glad to be here, Francis.
And you made it okay?
We made it okay, too.
Did you lose power at all?
We didn't even lose power.
That's fantastic. Neither did we. And so to the folks who were really ready to jump on Pepco's back about this, I hope you're happy with yourselves. At any rate, you each have chosen the news stories from this week that you think are most important to people who work for the federal government. So let's get started with
number three.
Ron Sanders, your third most important federal news story of the week is my colleague Jack Moore's story from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is Pay Gap Between Government and Private Sector Widens to 34%. Now, this is according to the Federal Salary Council, but this is one of those things. You and I have talked about this before. Everybody that looks at this looks at it differently and comes up with different numbers. What did you take away from what the Federal Salary Council had to say?
Well, it's a shame this didn't come out on Halloween with the old Orson Welles, you know, Mars Has Invaded, because I think it has about as much credibility. With all due respect to the Federal Salary Council, they are constrained by a system and a methodology that I think everybody knows is broken. And even if those numbers were credible, a gap of almost 35%, we all know the reality, given today's economy and unemployment, et cetera, that gap is not going to be closed, even if the numbers were credible. But I don't think the numbers are credible. The flaws in the current methodology are well documented, and I'm sure we would bore your listeners to death getting into the nuances of those competing methodologies.
But you might be surprised. I've met my listeners.
but the bottom line is the system is broken. It needs to be fixed. There's always been a great deal of inertia, sort of headwind as strong as Sandy, pushing back on anyone that wants to try to fix the federal pay system and the accompanying classification system, et cetera. They've been around now for almost as long as I have. But I think if this continues, we're just going to see more and more pay freezes, and it's going to increase the pressure to fix the system, and I think the system needs to be fixed.
I think the part of this that I was most surprised by was the swing here. Jack's story says the pay gap was 26% last year, and I just have a hard time thinking that either – if we go on the assumption that there was a pay freeze in government and federal employees' salaries didn't go up or down, then it's reasonable to assume from these numbers that the private sector would have had to have seen an 8% increase in the last year. And I don't know of anybody in the private sector that got an 8% raise last year.
No.
Am I off base there, or am I drawing the wrong conclusion?
No, you're on third base. And rounding for home, look, as I said, the irony is that these numbers came out when they did. And again, that's not faulting the Federal Salary Council or the process that OPM is constrained by. It's just that time of the year. But it just stirs the pot even more when folks who are looking for jobs see a gap like that and they say, what about generous federal benefits? What about the job security that comes with being a federal employee? I think all of those things need to be taken into account in figuring out what the annual pay increase or increases ought to be. And I'll emphasize the plural because I really think we're going to have to move to a system of job matching, looking at benchmark jobs, looking at our competitors, looking at total compensation, and then, Francis, allowing the executive, in this case the president and OPM and OMB, to exercise judgment. We, the Federal Employee Pay Comparability Act said the president can declare an economic emergency if he doesn't believe the numbers, and we've been in an economic emergency now since the enactment of the Federal Employee Pay Comparability Act. It's because you can't do this by formula. There needs to be judgment at the end of the day. So a system that that looks at job matches, that takes benefits into account, that looks at total compensation And then allows the president on the advice of OPM and OMB to make judgments. I think that's the fix that we're looking for. And I have my fingers crossed that somebody will take this on in the new administration, Romney 1 or Obama 2. Obama 2.
Ron Sanders' third most important federal news story of the week is Jack Moore's story on federalnewsradio.com, headlined Pay Gap Between Government and Private Sector Widens to 34%. Larry Allen, your third most important federal news story is from the Federal Times. The headline is GSA Chief Touts Agency's Response to Hurricane Sandy. We've been seeing story after story after press release about how agencies are responding. And I don't remember... I'm not saying it didn't happen. I just don't remember this avalanche of information about what the government did say during Irene or during Katrina.
Well, Francis, I think that's probably accurate. But by the same token, I think it's important to call out agencies that do respond. And in the case of the General Services Administration, have in fact responded in the Katrina and Andrew circumstances. With things that don't garner a lot of headlines normally, but nevertheless, if GSA wasn't supplying those things in a time of crisis, there wouldn't be the bottled water, there wouldn't be the shelters, there wouldn't be the things that people need to clean away the debris at the local level. So it's important things, and I think this is a case where the government should be telling some of the good news that it's performing.
Yeah, I certainly don't want to give the impression that I didn't think it was appropriate,
right,
because they did it. And one of the things I've been an advocate for ever since I've been in this job, been at this station, is help us tell people the good things that government does, because they do a ton of them. So I don't want to give the impression that I'm not saying they shouldn't be talking about these things.
No, right. And I think the main thing is, particularly about an agency like GSA that has maybe more than its fair share of criticism this past year for managerial problems, real and perceived, this is a case where Dan Tangerlini, the acting administrator, and his senior management team really set loose the assets that the agency brings to bear, the ability to conduct emergency procurements, the fact that we had good foreshadowing, we had good information before this storm actually came across landfall. So it gave the agency time to prepare so that when the call came, they were ready and could turn on a dime to provide the supplies and services they did. And that's exactly what they did here. I've talked to a couple of people in the agency this week briefly, and as you might expect, they've been putting in their 20-hour work days and responding to crises up and down the East Coast.
And one of the things that I thought was wise about the blog post that Dan Tangerlini put up, as though he cares what I think about his blog post, but he didn't just mention the procurement part of what GSA does. He also wrote about the agency looking for 100,000 square feet for FEMA to work out of on a temporary basis, so he kind of gave a shout-out to the Federal Building Service side of the agency, too.
Both of the things that GSA is responsible for, and if GSA wasn't able to do it and do it fairly quickly, then there would be a lot of people who felt the pain.
Larry Allen's third most important federal news story of the week on this week's Federal News Countdown is from the Federal Times. GSA chief touts agency's response to Hurricane Sandy. And of course, we'll talk more about Sandy throughout the course of the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. The second most important story of the week from Larry Allen and from Ron Sanders coming up. Long-term care insurance program. It's always a good time to apply. Long-term care is expensive and it's not covered by traditional types of insurance plans. You may need to rely on loved ones or pay for long-term care services out of savings or assets. Fortunately, the Federal Long-Term Care Insurance Program was designed to help protect against the high costs of care. Because premiums are based on your age at the time of application, this really is a good time to learn more. Visit LTCFEDS.com today.
Hi, this is Jim Fleisig. Please join me on Tuesday, November 6th at 12 noon for my monthly series, The Federal Executive Forum. This month's program will focus on big data in government, progress, and best practices. The panel includes government leaders from NGA and NASA Goddard. Don't miss the Federal Executive Forum on Tuesday, November 6th at 12 noon, right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com.
Sponsored by Lockheed Martin, NetApp, and SourceFire.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
I'm Emily Kopp. On Monday's Federal Drive, we're broadcasting live from the Government Contract Management Conference at the Renaissance Hotel in downtown Washington. We'll speak with Claude Bolton of the Defense Acquisition University and the Agriculture Department's Al Munoz busts some myths. It all starts at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. And for the latest federal news, check out federalnewsradio.com.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. The three most important federal news stories of the week are chosen every week on the Federal News Countdown by two guests who are experts in the world of the federal government. This week it's Larry Allen and Ron Sanders, and we are up two on the countdown.
Number two!
Ron Sanders, your second most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec, but it is written by our friend John Kaminsky from the IBM Center for the Business of Government. And the title of this is The Seven Essentials of Cross-Agency Collaboration, and he details them in this piece that is linked up on federalnewsradio.com. And he really gets to the core of this issue that agencies have struggled with, probably since there have been agencies that are working on the same thing under different roofs. Is that, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and I apologize. This is a bit of a nerdy subject, but it's something that I and others have gotten pretty passionate about, Francis, for the reason you just cited. I think more and more our great national problems require a whole-of-government approach. They cut across departments and agencies. The problems are horizontal, and we work in a vertical government, lots of stovepipes. Sometimes they like to refer to themselves as cylinders of excellence. But the cylinders don't do often don't do a very good job of communicating with one another. And I really like what people like Chris Mim and Laura Craig at GAO are doing. They've been studying this for a while. They've looked at places like the intelligence community and Homeland Security, where that's a, you know, sort of a mission essential ability. And the story is worth reading in part because these are Band-Aids. They are good Band-Aids. They talk about how agencies can work together in that vertical stovepipe world. But I really think we need to take this to the next level. We need an infrastructure that allows, that enables agencies to work more closely and collaboratively in that horizontal fashion. So I'll give you a good example with Sandy, and we may want to come back to this later. In terms of first response, the interagency coordination that FEMA and the incident commander and Homeland Security and others coordinate, you get an A+. They know how to do this in a crisis. We've learned some lessons along the way, sometimes painful. They know how to do this in a crisis. But think about what happened in this town. The vast majority of federal employees were teleworking. They were teleworking within their own agency IT infrastructures. And when it came to collaborating in the day-to-day business of government, they were back into their stovepipes. So while we were collaborating...
Cylinders of excellence.
The cylinders of excellence. So while on the scene, on the ground, you know, the interagency was alive and well and performing at a high level, in the back, the rest of government, the whole of government, we're suddenly finding ourselves back in those cylinders. And it's problematic because, again, whether it's counterterrorism or veterans' employment or homelessness or the environment or the economy, it's not one agency or one department. It's all of them working together. And, you know, the Model T wasn't built that way.
That's one of the things, Larry, that the Obama administration initially got some kudos for, because that was kind of where they took the Bush administration's president's management agenda, was to a more cross-agency approach where they said, we're going to evaluate what the whole of government does. Veterans homelessness was one that Ron mentioned that the administration started to work on. And we're going to evaluate how all of the agencies do that as a combined force rather than how VA does it and how HUD does it and how any of the other agencies do it.
Right. And in fact, Francis, I'd give OMB, this OMB, some good grades for looking at things on a government-wide basis in terms of a number of issues on the management agenda, including my favorite, government procurement and contracting, where you're talking about looking at things like strategic sourcing to find ways to leverage the government's collective buying power. You can argue about how it's implemented, but the idea that the government should be cooperating across agency lines to ensure that they're eliminating duplication and getting the best deal for their federal dollar, that's a pretty much a commonly held good. So this whole idea of collaboration across agencies, there are so many different facets to it that I hope that it doesn't become a nerdy topic, as Ron said. I hope it's something that continues to get some momentum, not just in this OMB, but moving forward.
Now, this is something that the military has been working on for, well, the concept of jointness for how long? A decade?
Oh, more,
15, 20 years?
Since 1985,
okay.
86, when Congress passed something called the Goldwater-Nichols Act. And visionaries back then in both the executive and legislative branch and in the military concluded that if the United States was going to be able to fight and, more importantly, win future wars, it needed to do it in a seamless, integrated way, deploying your land, sea, and air, and now space and cyber forces in a joint way. And that was antithetical to the way the military had operated pre-Goldwater-Nichols. Again, cylinders of excellence.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the world doesn't work that way anymore on the front lines. And so we're now in almost a quarter century now into – actually over a quarter of a century now into jointness in the military. And there are folks who would say that the success in Desert Shield and Desert Storm, and more recently in the intelligence community with all the emphasis placed on this post-9/11, the takedown of bin Laden, which, again, was a great example of jointness, special operators, intelligence, all-source, fused – command and control, we got them. All right, so that works in war. Can we make it work to employ veterans or clean up the environment or create jobs, et cetera?
That's exactly where I was headed with that, and in fact was going to go to the intelligence community next as an example of that, because that was my question, is are the lessons there to be learned? Are they applicable to the civilian agencies? And I mean, if you said what's the hardest culture in the government to change, I'd say it's got to be the military culture to change mindsets. I mean, all you got to do is go to one Navy football game and count how many times you hear "Go Navy, beat Army," and you understand at least to some, even just on a superficial level, what's been going on for the last 225 years of our history. And so that's why I wanted to go there. I just to see if that's a place where maybe agencies could look or OMB could look to say, how have they done it? That's how we should try to drive change.
I think that's been a great proof of concept, more on the civilian side. Of course, we have, again, a quarter century of experience with the military. And even when you go to an Army-Navy football game, the fact of the matter is every 05 and 06 and flag officer has walked a mile in the other service's shoes. And that's how you build those sorts of organizational networks and get that jointness. In the intelligence community, Congress gave the DNI the authority to establish the same sort of forcing function. Quite simply, if you wanted to be a senior executive, senior expert, whatever, in the intelligence community, you had to complete a civilian equivalent of a joint assignment. And that's been in place now for 5 years. And I think the intelligence community would number more than 10,000, and it may even be more than 15,000 today, people who've now had that, what they like to call an out-of-body experience. but when they come back, they're better leaders for it. And look, if you can do it with those cylinders of excellence, agencies that that are in the business of keeping secrets from one another as well as our enemies,
mm-hmm.
If you can break down those stovepipes, you can break them down elsewhere. So I think there's some lessons there.
I love the term cylinders of excellence. I've never heard that before, and that's beautiful. Ron Sanders' second most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. It's John Kamensky's column entitled "The Seven Essentials of Cross-Agency Collaboration." All of the stories that both Ron Sanders and Larry Allen have chosen on this week's Federal News Countdown are linked up now on federalnewsradio.com/ /in-depth. Larry Allen's second most important federal news story is next on the Federal News Countdown. This is In Depth with Francis Rose.
The Commuter Info Report brought to you by Commuter Connections.
Companies across the region are finding alternative modes of transit for their employees to better their quality of life and the economic vitality of the entire region. GEICO Direct was recently recognized by Commuter Connections for offering discounted Smart Trip cards and free carpool parking to its employees. The CoStar Group was honored for its 10-point commuter assistance program. Wells Fargo Home Mortgage in Frederick and Booz Allen Hamilton recently received awards for their commuting initiatives. I'm Dave Dildine.
These days, keeping your money is harder than ever. Some folks are even going to extremes like freezing money in blocks of ice, storing it under mattresses, hiding it under the litter box. We'd like to suggest something different, something easier. Sign up to Rideshare and save on gas. It'll help you keep your money.
Commuter Connections provides free ride matching and commuter services in the Washington metropolitan region. Sign up at CommuterConnections.org. That's CommuterConnections.org or call 800-745-RIDE.
Agency of the Month, sponsored by ICF International.
David Muntz from the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology talks about big data.
The research that we will be able to do associated with data is extraordinary, and we will be able to help society in ways that we can't even imagine today, but we know that it can happen.
Agency of the Month, Department of Health and Human Services, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, or online at federalnewsradio.com.
To have the greatest impact, you must tackle the most important problems. All over the world, ICF International applies strategy, science, and technology to help clients achieve measurable results, including healthier people and vibrant communities. This is ICF International, and their work helps government health programs, like those run by the National Institutes of Health, improve the quality of life. Find out how ICF's informatics, research, and communication work helps make a difference at ICFI.com.
Lifting away type 2 diabetes. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS HealthBeat. Men who do weight training consistently may reduce their risk of type 2 diabetes. Add aerobic exercise to their routine and their risk may drop even more. Researchers followed 32,000 men for 2 decades, adjusting results for other lifestyle factors. Men who did at least 150 minutes of weight training a week cut their risk of type 2 diabetes by more than 30%. Frank Hu is a professor of nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health.
Men who did aerobic exercise and weight training, their risk was reduced by more than 60%.
Who suggests men include both aerobic and weight training into their daily lives to get the most benefit? The study in the Archives of Internal Medicine was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Ron Sanders of Booz Allen and Larry Allen of Allen Federal Business Partners. And Larry, your second most important federal news story of the week is about Sandy. It's Joe Davidson's column in the Washington Post headlined, Storm Ramps Up Federal Teleworking. And you made a point during the break that I want you to make sure that you make on the radio. But what struck me the most about the teleworking aspect of this storm was I didn't really hear from anybody that I talked to in government either Wednesday or yesterday that said, you know, it was like a total dead start as it has been in the past. Maybe not everybody could telework. Maybe not everybody was prepared to telework, but enough people did so that when work resumed inside federal buildings on Wednesday, it didn't seem like everybody had been gone for 4 or 5 days as we would have experienced a year ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
Well, I think that that's right, Francis. It's an indication that telework is not a new concept, but it's one that is still really gaining ground to get up to equilibrium. But you can see the advantages when we have a crisis like a Hurricane Sandy of having the capability and the normalcy, if you will, of teleworking in the federal government. And what was notable to me is that it's the first time I can remember people on the media saying the federal government is actually not closed. Federal buildings were closed, but the implication was very strong that federal workers would be working and teleworking wherever possible. And while the buildings themselves were closed to the public, that did not equate, as you opened with, to a government shutdown. A lot of government agencies, not just the ones involved in disaster recovery, were hard at it.
The other element of that, Director Barry was very careful when he was on my program and in any of the other outreach OPM did to the media to say federal buildings in D.C. were closed. This also, Ron, I think was the first time, and maybe I'm wrong, that the emphasis was on federal buildings in the D.C. area or in Baltimore or in New York City and were closed, and making it very clear that that other 80% or whatever the number is now of people who don't work in the Northwest Corridor that work for the federal government, nothing's changed for them. Everything is working as normal unless you're in this area that's affected by the storm.
Right. I think this underscores one of the great values of telework. The fact that you can maintain continuity of operations in the worst of times, even in the D.C. area. Let's say, for example, we lost power. If you're teleworked, if you're connected as an organization, you can distribute a lot of that work to those parts of the country that aren't affected. I'm not sure we're there yet, but I think Sandy was a great stress test for some of the things that the Congress and John Barry in particular at OPM have been pushing for a couple of years. We pushed for this when I was at OPM, but it was like Sisyphus, you know, pushing the rock uphill. I do think the other lesson learned from Sandy is that you really have to take an integrated approach to be successful at the flexible workplace, because they shall remain nameless. But I know a number of agencies had so many people working from home that they had bandwidth problems. So, look, it's important to deal with the human resources, human capital issues around telework. It's important to deal with the program management and metrics and training issues around telework. But the real payoff, the real hard edge stuff, you got to worry about IT, data and network security and bandwidth. You got to worry about space management. That's where you get the savings. Telling you all at the break, Booz Allen has been able to give up a lot of very expensive real estate around Tyson's Corner because we've gone to about 70% of our workforce hoteling. They're either working at a client site or they're working at home. And when they want to work at one of our offices, they have to go to the concierge and check in. And sometimes there's no vacancy. They have to work at home. We've gotten very aggressive at that. And I know some federal agencies are following suit. Huge savings in real estate as you deal with that footprint. But to me, we saw the other great payoff with Sandy, and that's continuity of operations. Government buildings were closed. Government wasn't closed. That's a huge message, and I think we passed it.
Now, as I read between the lines or listen between the lines, Larry, of what Ron's talking about there, I hear something that potentially could be a major impact in your area of expertise, contracting and procurement, because if Ron's company is spending a lot less on real estate, they've got far lower overhead than maybe some of their competitors who haven't decided to make those same changes, and they're going to wind up winning a lot more business potentially if they're able to bid appropriately.
Well, it's certainly one aspect of cost management if you're a government contractor is managing your overhead, and real estate prices, and especially in this region, Francis, are a big part of that. It's a very competitive marketplace already in the federal government, however, and we're already seeing a lot of emphasis on driving to lower price. So this is maybe just as much of a way for a larger company or even a smaller one to stay competitive as much as it might be to get a competitive edge. We see the federal government doing this. They probably are going to be looking for their contractor business partners to be doing the same things that they are doing. Hey, look, if we lowered our cost by X percent because we're at a 5-to-1 or 7-to-1 ratio, as I think the new GSA headquarters building will be, why can't you, as our contractor partner, do the same? In fact, we expect you as our contractor partner to be right there with us.
Larry Allen's second most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. It's Joe Davidson's column, headline, Storm Ramps Up Federal Teleworking. It is linked up now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We're at the top of the chart, the most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Larry Allen and Ron Sanders on this week's Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose. We'll be right back.
For a faster, easier way for your agency to go green, choose GSA's Green Aisles, the custom online purchasing channels on GSA Advantage and GSA Global Supply. Each item in the Green Aisles is identified and labeled with environmental indicators like Energy Star, EPEAT, and more, so you can find the green products and services you need and meet all of your agency's sustainability requirements, environmental and economic. To learn more, join the conversation today at interact.gsa.gov/sustainability.
6 years ago, a Veterans Affairs laptop was stolen, containing information on 26 million veterans. The massive data breach catapulted cyber to the forefront of agency leaders' minds. But what's the state of cybersecurity today? Federal News Radio's special report, Cybersecurity Rising, examines the progress made and where the holes remain. Check out our timeline of cyber milestones, plus the top 10 items still on the government's to-do list. Exclusively on federalnewsradio.com, search Cybersecurity Rising.
Newsmakers, talk to Jason Miller on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Stephen Van Roekel is the federal CIO.
The mentality of let's cut the bottom of our list off, the things that are least effective, that are maybe duplicative, and let's take part of that and let's feed the top of the list. We can invest in innovation. We can invest in cost savings, efficiency, and effectiveness of our employees or services that touch citizens.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Larry Allen of Allen Federal Business Partners and Ron Sanders of Booz Allen. And we're up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Larry Allen, is fresh today from the New York Times. Jobs report shows persistent economic growth. And I have to say, I love the choice of the word persistent in that headline, as if at some point in time, economic growth tried to give up on its own and then decided not to and tried to continue persevering. What do you think of this number today?
I'm not nearly as smart as the headline writers for the New York Times, Francis, but I think that there's a little bit in this report for everyone. There are people who will say we created a number of jobs and the number of jobs we need to in order to sustain job growth overall in the economy. There are those who will say yes, but the overall rate went up 0.1%, and it's been kind of between 7.8% and 8% for a number of months now, and there's some anemia going on. I think that that's probably true. The federal implication, I think, gets into the fact that if you buy into the logic that I kind of buy into, that this is an anemic report and that we still have a little ways to go, it means that you really can't afford to lose a lot of the jobs that we already have, the ones that maybe we've just created or the ones that have been around for a little while. And yet, we know in the federal market, we are staring right down the barrel of potentially some fairly major job losses at the beginning of the calendar year, with things like the fiscal cliff coming that would affect the entire economy, and things like sequestration, the dreaded S word, that would particularly affect the federal market, although the ripple effect of that as well would be felt well outside the federal arena. So to me, this is an indicator that every job that we do have, we ought to work hard to maintain. It's not like the economy is creating extraneous jobs here and we're down below a full employment number. Not at all. We still need to create new positions at least the rate we did last month, as well as keep the ones that we have.
Now, Ron, I will confess, I'm with Larry. I don't know what this really means economically, but I look at this story from a completely different perspective. it ties into what we just talked about telework. There was a controversy going around, would the Bureau of Labor Statistics even be able to get these numbers out because of being the agency being quote unquote closed, I'm using air quotes right now, for 2 days. And I actually mentioned this on News Channel 8 on Wednesday night. I said, these people are teleworking, some of them, and if they've got power, they're able to continue to do whatever it is they do. The numbers, they're saying the number will be out on time. There's no reason not to believe them. 8:30 this morning, just like clockwork, we got the number. So in my opinion, a story like this says as much about that as it does about what the data actually includes.
I think that's a great point, because so much depends on the subtle, largely invisible things that government does. To come out with those numbers is no small feat. There are, you know, surveys with lots of lead time and lots of number crunching and lots of other things. And a lot of it happens at the 11th hour. In this case, the 11th hour happened to coincide with, I guess we're calling Sandy now a subtropical cyclone.
I'm just calling it Sandy.
Sandy is good. Whatever her official designation. And, you know, I think the public takes a lot of what the federal government does for granted. And I think this is a great example of that. If those numbers hadn't come out, I'm sure there would have been all sorts of hue and cry, especially during this election season. The fact that they came out just like clockwork in the middle of a subtropical cyclone is a tribute to, I think, not just the federal employees that produced the numbers, but the fact that the agency involved, in this case labor, had done their due diligence with continuity of operations planning. They obviously had a contingency plan to do this. I hope it didn't involve people in four-wheel drive vehicles trudging through the wind and the rain.
Trying to hightail it downtown.
No. So I think that's a great point. This was, again, and if you stopped and thought about it, how many other things happened during those 3 days when government buildings were closed?
Right.
But everything else worked,
mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great story.
The other part of this that I think that this story draws attention to, and you alluded to it already, is it's fine to say that you have a particular view about the size of government one way or the other. That's a perfectly legitimate dialogue to have. But my fear is that we're to a point now where that's not the conversation that's happening, especially in Congress. The conversation is, what do I say that it scores me points with the people that will return me to the job that I have now or to a higher job, rather than what is the best thing for the good of those people. And I'll just say what I've said a number of times on this program. This kind of thing is the citizen, the taxpayer, is going to be much better served when agencies, when there is a policy of determining every job, every program, everything that every agency does, and then a fair dialogue starts about, should we continue to do that or should we not continue to do that? And I know those conversations are not easy to have, and I know they're just as politically charged as the situation in which we find ourselves now, but that seems to me to be the only reasonable approach to get beyond just, you know, two rams smashing their heads against each other, which is what it seems to me we have right now.
Well, I think you're absolutely right about that. And, you know, we are here, and we get a lot of that in the crucible of Washington, D.C., especially 5 or 6 days out from an election. And we do tend to lose sight that the business of government does have to get done, whether it's sending out important economic reports like the overall employment number today, whether it is doing things for national defense, whether it is doing vital things for things like cybersecurity. There are missions that people expect out of their government, and they expect the government to do it in a timely manner and with a reasonable amount of accuracy. And that, I think, does get lost. And we've seen a lot of that over the past year, Francis, a lot of gotcha mentality, where the pendulum never stops at halfway. There's a lot to be said for making sure that we uncover wrongdoing, but there's also a lot to be said for keeping it in perspective of the overall manifestation that government has a mission. That's why we have a government.
Yeah. Ron?
Hopefully, whatever happens Tuesday, we all take a collective deep breath. We did a research report with the Partnership for Public Service around smart cuts, lessons learned from the budget wars of the 90s. And this is sort of deja vu all over again. You know, this will date me, but I was at DOD when we were in search of the last peace dividend and went through historic budget reductions, and then reinventing government came along, and that was layered on top. So we've seen deep cuts before, and that Smart Cuts report documented those budget cutting strategies that worked and those that didn't. And you've alluded to sort of the two ends of the continuum. The easiest way to do this is salami slicing. Everybody takes their hit, pays an equal tax, regardless of how efficient you are, how important your program is. The hardest way to do this is programmatically. Look at the performance of programs, do your triage, draw your line. Those below that line have to be terminated because they're just not adding value. All of the programs we look at are well-intentioned. Start with that as a given. No one's enacted something or appropriated something that is a complete waste of time. It has some value, but in this day and age, when the relative value is what's important, it's the, you know, it's taking that programmatic approach, but that's really hard. We can talk about this if you want in the next segment or not. It is, too, another nerdy subject, but there are strategies that have worked. They're proven. And again, I think once we get past the election, everyone will take a deep breath, and I have confidence that we'll do it smartly.
The most important federal news story of the week, selected by Larry Allen, is headline, Jobs Report Shows Persistent Economic Growth. You can find it linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, like all of our stories on this week's countdown. And Ron Sanders' choice for the most important federal news story of the week. We'll wrap up this week's countdown in just a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll be right back.
Now that I've moved to Washington, I need a new primary care doctor.
Got it handled.
And a gynecologist with appointment time.
Got it.
And a dermatologist who's taking new patients.
Got it.
And a safe pharmacy, one that doesn't make me nervous when I have to pick up prescriptions late after work.
Got it handled.
Okay, how exactly do you have it handled? It's my first week in Washington, and you have an entire integrated care team for me?
Yep. You just need to enroll in Kaiser Permanente. They have integrated medical teams, some of the best care sites, 24/7 availability for urgent care. They have convenient online tools and a mobile app. And now J.D. Power and Associates rank them highest in member satisfaction among commercial health plans in the Virginia, Maryland, and D.C. region 4 years in a row.
I can get all that just by joining Kaiser Permanente?
You got it.
When it comes to care teams, Kaiser Permanente is clearly the right choice.
For J.D. Power and Associates award information, go to jdpower.com. Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
The year was 1930. The epic flight that had made Charles Lindbergh a superstar was in the history books, and the Spirit of St. Louis was in the Smithsonian. But Lucky Lindy had his sights on a new challenge, a nonstop flight across the U.S. To accomplish this feat, he needed more than luck. He needed a new plane. For that, he turned to Lockheed, where under his watchful eye, the Lockheed Sirius took shape. In April of that year, with his wife Anne Morrow Lindbergh acting as co-pilot, he took off from Los Angeles and arrived in New York City a mere 14 hours, 45 minutes, 32 seconds later. They'd broken the record by 3 hours. 60 years later, another museum-bound aircraft, Lockheed Martin's SR-71, crossed the country in just over 1 hour and took its place alongside the Spirit of St. Louis. Their stories are our stories. See them unfold at LockheedMartin.com/100 years.
Pending legislation, federal budget cuts, contracting efficiencies, contract management best practices, acquisition trends, and the relationship of government and industry will be discussed at NCMA's upcoming 31st Annual Government Contract Management Conference, November 5th and 6th in Washington, D.C. Hear from Ted Leonsis, CEO of Monumental Sports and Entertainment, Frank Kendall, Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics, and General George Casey, former U.S. Army Chief of Staff. Learn more at ncmahq.org.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week. as selected by Larry Allen of Allen Federal Business Partners and Ron Sanders of Booz Allen. And, Ron, your most important story of the week is my colleague Jolie Lee's story, headlined, FEMA Pays Initial Costs of Sandy-Related Power and Transportation Operations. Now, she starts this story out by writing, the federal government's picking up the tab to restore power and provide transportation in the areas hardest hit by, she calls it post-tropical cyclone Sandy, which is correct from yesterday. I just call it Sandy because we talked about this during the break. It's different names at different times, and I'm not that bright, so it's hard for me to remember what it is today. So we'll just call it Sandy. What did you take away, though? You mentioned earlier in the program that you thought the initial response was an A+, and FEMA demonstrates they know how to do this, how to really tear into this, but it remains to be seen how this will play out over the next couple of days or week. What is your takeaway from Jolie's story here?
So we touched on this earlier when we talked a little bit about interagency collaboration. So I give the federal government working with state and local first responders an A+ for that first response, and including the sort of the indications and warning phase of this. Everyone was tracking it. We knew when it came ashore. The first responders were deployed. There was an unfortunate loss of life, but hopefully that was minimized by all the preventive measures, et cetera. So in the 24 hours preceding and 24 to 48 hours afterwards, I think the government, in this case includes all levels, gets an A+. The challenge is going to be to sustain that model of interagency collaboration and cooperation for the next week and the next month, because we were spared here, but by all accounts and by all the pictures we've seen on the news, it's going to take a while for the New York, New Jersey, greater metropolitan area to recover. And patience wears thin. I think we're already seeing that as people are waiting in line for hours and hours and hours for gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so how do we take what happened in the 24 hours before and 48 hours afterwards, that model of collaboration, how do we bottle it and sustain it? Because it's going to require that same interagency cooperation at the federal level, as well as that same intergovernmental cooperation between federal, state, and local to mitigate and remediate the damage. And so I think there, while I gave the government an A+ for the first response phase, I think there's an incomplete for the sustained phase. I think we need to see, and frankly, I think the more people like you and others in the media can keep focusing, because that's one way of holding government accountable, is to keep focusing on those gas lines and the flooded tunnels and making sure that government is not only doing everything each jurisdiction can do alone, but doing everything that all of those jurisdictions can do working together once the crisis is passed. One last thing, and I'll shut up. I've worked very closely with a colleague, Lenny Marcus. He's a professor up at Harvard who's been studying the behavior of leaders in crisis now since 9/11. And he's got a great framework, a great model. He's been down and actually has conducted courses for the federal government, including for OPM and John Berry's folks and our Leading Edge program, the one we're doing government-wide for all executives. And I saw a lot of the behaviors that Lenny has modeled in his framework at work with the president, with Governor Christie, with Mayor Cuomo. You can see it, and the crisis brings everybody together. Okay, again, now that we're in the cleanup phase and money is tight and tempers are hot and patience is thin, how do we sustain it? I think that's going to be the test.
Now, that strikes me that is a basic knowledge management issue, and you and I have talked about the knowledge management issues all across government in the past. But, Larry, this goes to what Ron was saying earlier about cylinders of excellence. One of the things that we talked about the various agencies that have responded in various forms a little bit earlier in the program, I will say that for all of the the avalanche of material that I've gotten, rightfully so, about how agencies were responding. I don't remember seeing many, if any, where one agency said, here's what we're doing, and we're doing this in collaboration with some other agency, and we're doing this in collaboration with some other agency. And I'm certainly not implying that that's not happening, because I just don't know. I just know I didn't hear much about it. And so if nothing else, there still is that mindset, at least, that we're doing this, this is our job, and we're doing this, and we're not going to go outside that lane.
Well, I think that that's probably right, Francis, and I think there are probably a couple of reasons for it. One is each agency wants to talk about the good news story that it's providing. Here, Ron's story talking about FEMA. FEMA, an agency that we all remember was excoriated for some of its Katrina response. So they're still, I think, probably very stung from that experience. They want to make sure they get out ahead of the curve these days whenever a disaster does strike. I think also we can predict that there will be numerous oversight hearings in Congress. Ron mentioned the need to make sure oversight stays high. That's a given in this environment. I would expect we'll start to see oversight hearings as early as December. And one of the chief issues, you can bet, is going to be, why are there long gas lines? And that's not really fair for an agency like FEMA or GSA, because they don't really have control over things like that. Nevertheless, we will see that type of oversight. And I think that's another reason why the agencies want to get out and make sure they're creating their goodwill. And in the meantime, telling the good news story that they have every right to tell.
I will only disagree with you on one statement that you made. Congress comes back November 15th, so I don't think it will take them till December to get around to holding hearings about this. On the knowledge management piece, Ron, are there best practices that are not necessarily applicable or not necessarily gathered from emergency situations that could apply to a situation like this where somebody can come along behind what the agencies are doing, whether it's agency staff or somebody like you or someone else, and say, here's what they're doing to do that knowledge management that you're talking about so that the next time this happens, because we know there'll be a next time, there's something definitive somewhere.
Right. And again, I think the problem is compounded by the fact that while individual agencies, and many of them have great knowledge management apparatus, is that right?
I'll take your word for it.
Plural.
You're better at Latin than I am.
They do it well within their own ranks. It's the cross-agency lessons learned. That's what's hard. You can look at the military, you look at the IC, you can look at examples like the VA-HHS attack on veterans' homelessness as models where the interagency effort worked well. And hopefully, again, we can learn how to bottle that and apply it in a day-to-day sense.
Your most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is FEMA pays initial costs of Sandy-related power and transportation operations. The most important story of the week is selected by Ron Sanders of Booz Allen. Larry Allen also on the countdown this week from Allen Federal Business Partners. Gentlemen, a great show. Thank you very much for being on it. Ron, you should come back and do this again.
I'd be happy to, Francis.
And
thanks.
Ron, of course, or Larry, of course, you'll do it for sure.
I'll be back.
I'll look forward to it. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Hour number two of In-Depth with Francis Rose is coming next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.